you for tuning in to episode 225 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.FM or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or other programs. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. PRN.FM has voicemail. Call 862-800-6805, and as well as a message or question for this show, leave your name and indicate that the question is for The Infectious Myth. If you dial either of these numbers, long-distance charges may apply. I don't know that you're a listener until I hear from you, so send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it. If you include your mailing address, I'll send you a little thank you gift, one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. I really do love to hear from my listeners, so don't be shy. You can make a one-time donation to the expenses of the show via PayPal using the email david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com or commit to monthly donations at patreon.com or liberapay.com, LIBERAPAY. In both cases, we are Infectious Myth, one word. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of, on any topic you think I have an interesting and worthwhile opinion on, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. Speaking of listeners, here's some feedback from MH in New Zealand. Hi, David. I finally did get a chance and listen to your measles show. It was quite informative, but not to be critical, I think you didn't present the information as well or clearly as you could have. The following show with the Australian scholar, that was Judy Weilerman, episode 214, who covered some of the same material was clearer. But I'm not writing to criticize you. I really do enjoy your podcast. It was great to hear Paul Connett and his colleague, that was Bob Dixon, on why fluoridation is not only wrong, but moronic and or evil. I heard Paul when he came to New Zealand a few years ago to speak on this subject. He's an excellent speaker and so brilliant and well-informed. It's a disgrace that his advice is so often overlooked. We don't have fluoride here in the city where I live, but some New Zealand cities do. I wonder what your views are on euthanasia-assisted suicide. I'm very opposed. You may not know this, but the New Zealand Parliament is currently considering adopting a bill in favor of this. Would you be interested in covering this topic? If so, I can recommend an excellent person to you, and she would cover it on ethical, practical, economic grounds, etc., not focusing on religion at all. I did actually cover euthanasia in episode 167, talking about Andy Reese's documentary Endgame Assisted Suicide. As for my personal opinion, it's not fully formed. It's not one side or the other. I see some people who are in excruciating pain with no help of living, who I believe need euthanasia, need assisted suicide if that's the route they choose. But I am concerned about young people who may be depressed, considering assisted suicide and diseases that possibly could be overcome. So I'm not dogmatic on this. I'm not completely opposed to it. And I see that it could be abused, perhaps to get rid of an inconvenient elderly relative who has a will with lots of money in it, things like that. So there is definitely a potential for abuse. And there are people who may ask for it because they're going through a period of depression and not actually suffering from a life-threatening illness. But it is something that maybe I should cover again in the future. And I am following up with the person that this listener put me in touch with. Let's go to today's interview. William Malone is an MD and board-certified community-based endocrinologist with 10 years' experience, currently working in southern Idaho. He obtained a BA in human biology from Stanford University and then an MD from New York University. After medical school, he completed a 3-year residency program in internal medicine and then a 2-year fellowship in endocrinology, diabetes, and metabolism at the University of California, Los Angeles County Hospital. Welcome to the show, Will.
Thanks very much, David.
So you have a lot of concerns with the use of hormones, which is why I'm talking to you today. And hormones are far more common than what might be called gender affirmation surgery. But before we get to that, do you have any problems with the current trend towards affirmation in general and early social transitioning from one sex to the other?
Yeah, so there's a couple problems with it. So the first is affirmation is in and of itself a controversial approach to gender dysphoria. So there are actually three models of approach, and affirmation is only one, and it's the most controversial. The reason that it's the most controversial is that when applied to children and adolescents, it likely prevents them from resolving their gender dysphoria. So that's the major concern. The major concern is that because the majority of kids, if observed or supported, especially with a therapeutic or a modified therapeutic model of what's called psychological support, the overwhelming majority, we've got studies going back to 1995, the overwhelming majority of those kids will have resolution of their gender dysphoria as they pass through puberty and into early adulthood. And I think that's something that we should touch on as well, this issue of who will persist and who will desist. There's a lot of controversy about that, but those are the main issues. The main issues are, number one, it's controversial. Affirmation was not used by Ken Zucker. Mm-hmm. And is not used by the Dutch clinic, the Dutch National Clinic, that they consider themselves the pioneers of transgender medicine. They use a therapeutic or a modified therapeutic model, which focuses on developmental factors that could have or are contributing to the gender dysphoria, really with an effort to resolve any of those if possible, because they have a realistic understanding that hormones and surgery is a risky road that is not easy.
Yeah, we'll talk about some of the consequences of hormones later. I think I've heard that something like 80% or 85% of children with gender dysphoria will either desist, which is like stop the process, or detransition, which is to start to try to return by age 20. Does that concord with what you've?
Yeah. So the literature, there are studies back to about 1995, and the most. So if you summarize all of those studies together, the number in the literature, and this is actually cited by the Endocrine Society guidelines for the management of gender dysphoric youth and adolescents, the number cited is 84%. So it's somewhere in the mid 80s%, mm-hmm, when you look at all studies of kids who passing through puberty. And again, the process of resolution of gender dysphoria is poorly understood. Exactly, mm-hmm, why it resolves, when it resolves, et cetera, that's a matter of significant debate, except for those who are, in particular in the U.S., working in gender clinics, who claim that they can tell who will persist and who will desist in an early state of puberty. And that's false. There are no clinical ways to do that in any reliable fashion. Ken Zucker himself has kind of debunked that theory that clinically desistance can be or persistence can be determined. So yes, the literature says about 85% of kids, if allowed to go through puberty, will have resolution of gender dysphoria, or at least resolution enough where they do not want to pursue cross-sex hormones or sex reassignment surgery. And I think it's important to state that that number applies. So this data only applies to childhood onset gender dysphoria. Mm-hmm. So there's a new phenomenon, and it's got two names. One is rapid onset gender dysphoria. The other is adolescent onset gender dysphoria. And they essentially both describe the same phenomenon. These are, adolescent, pubertal or post-pubertal boys and girls who present with gender dysphoria having no significant clinical history of childhood gender dysphoria. We don't understand the natural course of that phenomenon yet. And it may be that if the onset of an individual's gender dysphoria is at age 15, for example, it may take 10 years or so for resolution of that dysphoria until mid or late 20s. We simply don't know. But the literature about children is 85% will resolve if allowed to go through puberty.
Right. And of course, if they're encouraged to transition, a lot of things may have happened, like the hormones or even surgery, before they decide that was a mistake.
That's a huge point right there.
Yeah. So it becomes irreversible at some point, right? Or not completely reversible, even if you decide to change.
Yeah, it's well accepted, I would say, that the human brain does not fully mature until early 20s, and you could argue that if someone has a condition that has delayed social development, for example, an autism spectrum condition, that full brain maturation may not occur until much later than that. So
that's something I wanted to talk about, is that one thing I've read a lot is that children with gender dysphoria rarely have that by themselves. They also tend to have a lot of other psychological disorders, such as eating disorders, autism, depression, often a history of self-harm, threats or attempts at suicide, things like that. Is that also your experience?
Yeah, and that's described in the literature as well, that there's a high rate of comorbid psychiatric conditions.
One thing I wanted to ask, people talk a lot about the Tanner stages, which are stages of puberty. Mm-hmm. And often treatment such as puberty blockers or cross-sex hormones is linked to what Tanner stage it is. A question that I had is whether it's absolutely clear, like if there were 10 therapists of different kinds considering one child, would they all agree on the Tanner stage, or is there some potential for bias or different opinions?
So I think there's some variability, but the stages of pubertal development have been fairly well established. So a pediatrician, for example, or a pediatric endocrinologist, I think there would be pretty uniform agreement about what Tanner stage 2 is. It's early puberty, and the reason so Tanner stage 2 was chosen as, I would say, really not based on any literature. The theory here is that if you block the development of secondary sexual characteristics, theoretically, long-term, an individual who is trying to pass as the opposite sex in society to relieve gender dysphoria would have fewer development of those secondary sexual characteristics if you block puberty early on. Yet, with this information, we have that there is resolution of most gender dysphoria through puberty. Mm-hmm. The reason that they're not blocking Tanner stage 1 or even before the onset of all puberty is whether they're trying to figure out how to how to catch the kids who are going to be persistent. But Tanner stage two is too early for that. And that's not just my opinion. This is.
And what would Tanner stage two be in just in a boy or a girl?
So basically it's early development of secondary sexual characteristics. So you're going to have, early breast development, and there are specific descriptive, textbook. So you have to do a careful physical examination to determine mm-hmm. that, but there are specific characteristics of breast development and, body hair development that gauge, the different Tanner stages.
Mm-hmm. Now, if children are put on puberty blockers, which are often I've seen them described as postponing puberty, because for currently, my understanding is that girls who start puberty before age 10 may be put on puberty blockers because it's considered too early to go through puberty.
So precocious puberty, yeah. So
yes.
Yes.
So are puberty blockers reversible? So if a girl says, I want to become a boy, and goes on puberty blockers, and then a year later says, no, I don't really think so, is she going to go back to exactly where she was and then continue forwards on a female puberty?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I think in theory, and certainly from experience with precocious puberty, so puberty starting earlier than it should. Mm-hmm. So if you use a puberty blocker in that situation, so let's say an 8-9-year-old entering puberty, and you delay the onset of their puberty so that they go through puberty at the time of their peers.
Mm-hmm.
As far as we know, there are no significant long-term issues with that. But I don't think we can, at this point, say that applies to a situation where you have a kid going through normal puberty. So let's say age 13 or 14, and you block that puberty, and the rest of their peers continue on with social, intellectual, and physical development.
Mm-hmm.
You essentially stall that child's development at age 14. And so a year or two later, the way that I describe this is essentially you're still dealing with a 14-year-old. So that child's development has been halted along multiple fronts. And there are issues with bone density that have been raised, concerns about brain maturation and IQ. So while it is technically true that if you stop a puberty blocker at age 15 and do not give cross-sex hormones, that adolescent will go through puberty later.
Mm-hmm.
But it is completely unstudied and unknown what the effects of delaying natural puberty is. And I think that's one of the points that the editor-in-chief of the British Medical Journal kind of boldly stated in a statement in the early part of this year. He said essentially that puberty blockers are being used in a state of profound scientific ignorance. So your question is a fantastic one. Yes, theoretically it's reversible, but practically is it? And we don't know the answer to that.
I think I'm talking about the same BMJ article from early this year. It mentioned problems with brain structure and circuitry, falls in bone mineral density, increase, this was surprising to me, increase in hemoglobin and hematocrit, red blood cells, and cardiovascular health.
Yeah. So the puberty blockers impact bone density development. So adolescence is the time for all of us. So puberty, adolescence is the time for maximum bone density development.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens on puberty blockers is that halts. So instead of the bone density climbing rapidly as it should, it actually levels off. And then that child's peers will all continue to rapidly put on bone density. And it's not clear even in situations where cross-sex hormones are then given after a year or two of puberty blockade, if those hormones allow for that bone density to return to what it normally would be. So we don't know if that's a permanent delay or a partial one, or it's completely unknown. The impact on brain development is also, I think it's fair to say, unknown as well. You know, there are case reports of IQs dropping on puberty blockers. There are some imaging studies looking at myelinization of brains. In particular, it looks like testosterone is very important for normal male brain development. And those studies didn't really show that they were imaging studies. Functional imaging studies didn't show differences. But again, we just don't have the data. And that's one of the main complaints here, is that the cart is way in front of the horse.
We've had experience with puberty blockers in girls. Has there been much experience with puberty blockers in boys before this era of giving it to boys who want to become trans women?
Yeah, I think the short answer is no. You know, there is some experience. There have been some precocious. There are some boys who have precocious puberty, but I think you're exactly right on the money here, which is this. We're profoundly scientifically ignorant of the effects of these interventions on these kids.
Could puberty blockers affect fertility, or do we know that puberty blockers for, say, a year or two will not reduce fertility in the future?
Yeah, so that's another great question. So puberty blockers alone, if halted and then natural puberty occurs, there should not be any significant impact on fertility in that situation. Mm-hmm. But if puberty blockers are followed by cross-sex hormones, and if the puberty blocker was started in early puberty, so Tanner stage 2, it's an almost certainty that that individual is permanently infertile.
Mm-hmm. So in a boy, the testes will not fully develop and will not produce semen, and in the girl, the ovaries will not fully develop and would not produce eggs.
Correct. Yes. And the I heard some commentary by a physician working at a major university gender clinic, and he stated that approximately half of their cases, their caseload, half are kids who have been puberty blocked at Tanner stage 2 and are therefore infertile. The other half were blocked or treated with cross-sex hormones after Tanner stage 2. And so there are some options for fertility for them long-term. But it's not an insignificant number of kids who are being rendered permanently infertile by a therapy that we do not fully understand.
Yes, I guess if it was proven to be what it's often said to be, you know, life-saving for these children, absolutely necessary, then, you know, maybe the risk of fertility would be worth it. And in fact, if a child persists and continues with cross-sex hormones and then maybe with surgery, they are going to be infertile, correct?
Yeah. Well, so again, I think it depends on, if the testes are removed, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Of course, that man is going to be infertile. And the same if a hysterectomy and oophorectomy are performed on a woman, she will be infertile.
Now, my understanding is that libido is connected with the gonads, the testes or the ovaries. Yeah. So do we know that there won't be a reduction in libido in these children?
Yeah. So there are two concerns along those lines. So the first is if you block a kid at Tanner stage 2, essentially halting physical development of their body, including the genitalia. And then if they go on to cross-sex hormones and sex reassignment surgery, so the term that I use is feminizing or masculinizing surgery, because sex can actually be changed. But if they go on to feminizing or masculinizing surgery,
we were talking about libido. So.
Yeah. Okay. Lost my train of thought. So what will happen is you're essentially left with immature genitalia for that surgical procedure. Mm-hmm. And there are significant concerns, first of all, about sexual function, ability to orgasm in particular. The second issue is, the hormones themselves. So testosterone in particular drives libido. Mm-hmm. And men normally have testosterone levels, depending upon the reference lab and the range, but comparably, let's say a testosterone level of 600 and a woman will have a testosterone level of 30. Mm-hmm. So it's quite a radical difference, and conversely the same with estrogen. So a woman's estrogen level, depending upon the stage of cycling, will be perhaps 200 or so, and a man's normal estrogen level really never will climb above 20. So there's a 10 to 20 fold difference in hormone levels. And we do know that women, for example, who take testosterone, they'll report increased libido. Men who are deprived of testosterone will have significant reductions in libido.
Mm-hmm. So it would be a bigger problem for transgender women.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
Now, what are some of the medical risks of transgender men, biological women taking testosterone? I believe cardiovascular disease is higher, for example.
Yeah. So I divide up the. What I like to do is divide up the impacts kind of into short term and long term. Mm-hmm. So the cardiovascular risk is definitely a major concern. We know this in men in general who take testosterone later in life for a variety of indications. There is concern that there's an increased risk of heart disease, even in men who are taking testosterone. So there was a study recently done showing that women who take male levels of testosterone will have the odds of them having a heart attack is four times higher. And as they age and as more time goes on, so it's not like that risk is immediate, but overall, if you look at a period of time, the risk of a woman taking a male dose of testosterone, her odds are four times higher than a woman's risk and two times higher than a man's risk. So one of the
odds of cardiovascular disease.
Yes, of an actual heart attack.
Okay.
And this is one of the misconceptions about cross-sex hormones is that sometimes women are told that, well, if you take a man's dose of testosterone, your risk of heart disease will be comparable to a man's. But it's not only higher than a woman's, it's actually twice the male risk, according to this study that was released.
And what about with biological males, transgender women taking estrogen?
Yeah, so estrogen, one of the main issues with estrogen, oral estrogen in particular, is based on the way it's metabolized through the liver, it increases the production of clotting factors. So it makes the blood more sticky. Mm-hmm. This is the main risk, even in women who take oral contraceptives, for example. This is the main counseling point to get across, is that there's this risk of blood clot, and in particular in the leg, and then that can dislodge and travel to the lungs, mm-hmm. which can be life-threatening. So men who take estrogen, there's another recent study, I think in the last 18 months or so, it showed that, and this was related specifically to the estrogen, that they will develop blood clots in their legs and strokes at 2 to 3 times the rate of the general population. And this is not surprising. This should not surprise anybody who knows or prescribes estrogen. That is the main issue with this drug.
And in both cases, I mean, let's take them separately. Are these hormones reversible? So, for example, if a transgender man starts to generate male type body hair, an Adam's apple, a deeper voice, etc., is any of that reversible when they stop, if they stop testosterone?
Yeah, so the voice changes occur, the deepening of the voice occurs within about 3 to 6 months of initiating testosterone, and that is not reversible, because an actual physical structural change occurs to the larynx and the voice box as a consequence of the testosterone exposure. Mm-hmm. And so that's not reversible. There are some facial changes, as well, and hair and skin changes. The extent of the reversibility, I think, depends upon the length of time that individual has been exposed to the drug. I can't say, if someone were to ask me, if, you know, someone comes in and says, okay, how is this going to go away? The answer is, it depends how long you've been on it, and we're going to have to wait and see. But certainly the voice change is irreversible.
Irreversible.
Yeah.
And with transgender women, I guess the major effect would be the enlarging of the breasts.
Yes.
Are those reversible?
So not without surgery. So men do have some glandular tissue under their nipples that can grow, and mm-hmm. that's what estrogen will do. It will cause a growth of that tissue. It's called gynecomastia, and once that tissue develops, even if you withdraw the stimulating hormone, in this case estrogen, it will not go away without it being surgically removed.
I think it was something that you posted where there was something about a drug interaction between a sulfa antibiotics and spironolactone, which is, yeah. is a name that I didn't, you'll have to explain that name to me.
Yeah.
What was the significance of that drug interaction?
Yeah, so I think, part of a physician's job is to educate patients and people about the potential side effects of drugs. And so spironolactone is a drug that blocks the binding of testosterone to tissues. So even if you have high circulating testosterone levels, for example, it's actually an it's a blood pressure drug, but it has this effect as well. It'll block the binding of testosterone to tissues and therefore prevent the effects of testosterone, for example, on facial hair growth.
Mm-hmm.
So spironolactone is used to as a part of the feminizing regimen for men who identify as women. And when combined with a common antibiotic, and so any person who takes spironolactone should know this, regardless of the indication or reason that they're taking it. When combined with Bactrim, which is a very common antibiotic used for a variety of reasons, urinary tract infections, skin infections, and everything in between, that the two together can cause a rapid rise of blood potassium levels, which can initiate a cardiac arrhythmia, leading to immediate and sudden cardiac death. And so there was a series, actually out of, it was done in Ontario, and they discovered over 300 people. Now, these were older individuals, but they discovered 300 people who had been treated with spironolactone, and within 14 days of taking this antibiotic, they died of sudden cardiac death.
That sounds pretty serious. Now, do you know much about the counseling that is given to children or or adolescents experiencing gender dysphoria in terms of what some of the consequences, the health consequences could be? And are adolescents in a position to properly evaluate the future dangers that they may experience?
Yeah, so you mean consent process to what they're getting into?
Yes, like if a child, I'm using a child in the terms of, you know, somebody under 18,
yeah,
is considering some kind of hormone therapy, presumably there will be some counseling for consent, right?
Does
that properly inform them about the potential dangers, and do they have the capacity to understand it?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and that's been debated robustly in the international literature. And that's one of the things that I am most disappointed about with the U.S. medical societies. They have not, through their main meetings or publications, educated physicians about the discussions that are occurring about issues exactly like you just raised. How do we determine, so just even practically, how, so we know that the majority of kids, it appear, who are treated with puberty blockers go on to cross-sex hormones. So essentially what that means is if a kid is puberty blocked at age 12, 13, 14, they're essentially consenting to a treatment that will result in lifelong infertility. Now, you know, we don't practice that way in any other aspect of medicine. So, in gynecology, for example, it's a well-established practice that a woman, they will not do hysterectomies on women roughly under the age of 25 because these doctors have had experiences where women have wanted a hysterectomy at age 18 or 19 and were absolutely certain that they did not want children and then changed their mind later. So there's this known understanding that the more serious the decision and the more severe the potential consequences, you know, the older you should be before making that sort of decision.
And we were talking about libido, and you talked about possibly the inability to have an orgasm if because of cross-sex hormones. I mean, how can a child who's never experienced that decide whether or not that's something they're willing to forego or to take a risk that it won't happen in the future?
Yeah, these are exactly the... I wish this sort of conversation was occurring at the Endocrine Society meetings. I mean, these are the sorts of, you know, I mentioned to somebody before, actually I've mentioned to several people, you know, at these meetings that we attend, there are often point-counterpoint discussions in a room with 1,000 physicians, 1,000 endocrinologists. And in 2018, there was a point-counterpoint between two of the world's experts in managing a particular type of adrenal nodule that can cause life-threatening hypertension.
Okay.
So we had a guy from the Mayo Clinic and a guy from one of the universities in the UK, both internationally known and well-published and highly respected. And they stood up in front of us and they argued back and forth, one in favor of a surgical management, the other in favor of medical management, for the better part of, you know, 45 minutes. And they went through all of the minutiae that you would expect that would be important to making a decision about surgery versus medicine for a medical condition. They went through cost analysis. They went through outcome studies. They went through personal experiences. They went through institutional experiences. It was really impressive to witness.
Mm-hmm.
Yet when it comes to this issue, at these major meetings, we've had absolutely zero debate. There's been no one there who is critical of affirmation therapy. We've had no lectures from Ken Zucker or anyone from the Dutch clinics or Ray Blanchard or Michael Bailey. None of these respected individuals who have a ton of experience in this field and are critical of affirmation. And so it's really been the consequence of that failure of dialogue has allowed this misperception that affirmation is the only treatment, and the only discussion allowed at this point is how do we make hormones and surgery safer, not whether or not it is actually the appropriate treatment for the majority of people.
Right. I mean, the way I see the current sort of public discussion is there's sort of the progressive side is that we need to support transgender children by giving them what they want. And then there's the other side basically saying this is a moral failing. And, there's no sort of scientific discussion of, you know, what is the best approach for these children? Do we need to affirm their condition or try to work on them accepting their body? I recently read an article describing bulimia, which is, I believe that's where you vomit to try to lose weight. So you eat, you vomit, you eat, you vomit. It's a very dangerous cycle.
Yes.
That there's strong evidence that that was a social contagion, that it had not really existed. But when it was publicized, it all of a sudden millions of cases occurred.
Yes.
And I don't know if you know about that research, but I've talked about rapid onset gender dysphoria, and do you believe that it's kind of a social contagion, that there's so much talk about it that children are being influenced in this way?
Yeah, I think that's what's being described, and there's one paper now published describing that very what you just said, which is oftentimes in peer groups there will be multiple individuals who will in rapid succession declare a transgender ID or a non-binary ID. What's been described as well is often preceding that is a heavy consumption of internet material, essentially supporting hormones and surgery as a treatment for dysphoria. So yes, I think those parallels are certainly present, and significant study needs to be done to understand if that's the case, because if we've been through this before, and this is another example of this, well, we should get better this time through and sound the alarm sooner.
Right. There was a recent letter in Archives of Sexual Behavior, I think I might have seen it on your Twitter feed, by three doctors from the UK, basically advocating that things such as parallel treatment of these coexisting psychological conditions, which is basically what you're advocating. Do you feel that there are more professionals speaking up, as well as perhaps parents of transgender children and even some of the desisters as well?
Yeah, it seems that seems to be occurring, and I'm glad to see that. The Royal College of General Practitioners, it's a 50,000 member group in the UK, released this statement recently, essentially really stating the truth that there is no evidence to support gender affirmation therapy. There's a void of evidence. The Endocrine Society themselves actually, if you look at the guidelines, they're not even shy about that. They state that there's really no evidence to support their position, and they rely on a single study of about 70 kids that had no control group to support puberty blockade and cross-sex hormones. So in children and adolescents, I agree with these position statements that are being released. The BMJ editorial, now the Royal College of General Practitioners, and now we're seeing there was a clinician recently who worked at the gender clinic in London, I believe. She resigned because of what she saw occurring, and she recently publicly posted her her reflections on what had occurred during her time there. And basically, everyone is really saying the same thing, which is affirmation is unproven. It's unproven to do what it's being said it will do. It is proven to be highly risky in terms of these hormonal and surgical interventions. And the rapid onset gender dysphoria cohort is unstudied and not understood. And the application of the childhood gender dysphoria protocol is to them is inappropriate because it's a separate entity that we don't understand.
Have you experienced any pressure or censorship in you speak a lot about this on your Twitter feed, and you've written articles and letters. Have you experienced any pressure to stop what you're doing?
I would say nothing substantial. You know, in private, the majority of physicians that I speak with are grateful when I share the literature with them that shows the truth about what's happening. Most don't have experience with this condition because prior to the rapid onset gender dysphoria or adolescent onset gender dysphoria wave, it was a very small number of individuals who had persistent gender dysphoria that would go on to cross-sex hormones and surgery. And so most had little experience, and the entire medical community in general, I would say, is undereducated about what's occurring. And this, again, is where I fault the medical societies, because one or two lectures from a respected thought leader on this issue, critical of affirmation, or at least raising the fact that there's no evidence for its application to children and adolescents, would immediately signal it's okay to start questioning and using the same reasoning that we apply to every other aspect of medicine. But that hasn't happened, and it's essentially been a what I can see is that a small group of individuals have pushed affirmation out as the standard of care with no evidence to support that. And because the medical societies have prevented any pushback against that idea, it's now accepted throughout the medical community as the standard of care because they don't know the literature. They haven't actually looked at the primary sources. And doctors, by nature, we tend to trust our medical societies. This might change that. But if you don't have experience with a condition and then a medical society that you have grown up to trust in aspects of thyroid cancer and diabetes and all the other things that we manage puts out a guideline stating that this is the best way to do this now, most are going to not fight that. And if they're uncomfortable with it, what they will do is they will refer a patient to a gender clinic where essentially they will get put down the affirmation pathway.
Have you tried to request that the Endocrine Society in the U.S., you know, change to provide some, you know, binary information? So, like you said, yeah. Somebody to promote it, somebody to criticize it.
Yeah, the group that I worked with that published the letter to the editor of the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Diabetes, which is the Journal of the Endocrine Society. The group, I have not personally, but we also have approached both endocrine organizations and asked for a point counterpoint, and it's been denied essentially. Now, I think part of that is because the affirmation practitioners will not agree to it. And this is a recurring theme as well, which is they will only engage in dialogue after you agree that affirmation therapy is the standard of care.
That's not really dialogue, then, is it?
Right. So it's okay to talk about how to make you know, hormones and surgery safer and better, but you're not actually allowed to discuss whether or not affirmation should even be being applied to the majority of these cases.
Yes. And what are the forces pushing this? I mean, are some practitioners making a lot of money? Is it a small number of transgender activists who are trying to silence any dissent? Like, do you have a feeling for what are the forces that are pushing this so successfully?
Yeah, it'd be speculation on my part. I think it's a combination of all the things that you said. And I don't think that, so initially, the rapid onset gender dysphoria, the adolescent onset gender dysphoria, has really changed the landscape. Mm-hmm. And, you know, affirmation, I think, was intended really only to be applied to childhood onset gender dysphoria. That in and of itself is controversial. And there's a ton of literature, and we've discussed some of it here, about why that's controversial. So even at a baseline, the childhood protocol is fraught with problems. So I don't think they believed the initial reports of the rapid increase in predominantly adolescent girls with no history of gender dysphoria. And so it's not addressed in the guidelines. And to date, they haven't really addressed this phenomenon that we're seeing clinically. And so it's a real failure on their part. I think they intended affirmation for the 0.5% of kids who have gender dysphoria, 0.5%, and now incorrectly that's being applied to this new cohort of rapid onset.
I think an important point you've made that maybe needs to be repeated is that affirmation, even if it's just social affirmation, will dramatically increase the chance of proceeding to puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones.
Yes.
So it kind of locks in. So even though social affirmation is something that in theory is easily reversible, in practice, maybe not.
Yeah, and actually, someone from the UK, part of their national system, recently just stated exactly that, which is early social transition is likely causing harm by preventing resolution of gender dysphoria, and he discouraged it. I don't have that in front of me right now, but that was a recent statement that was made for exactly that reason.
You've said that nobody's born in the wrong body. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so you know, every nucleated cell, so every cell that has a nucleus in a male or female body has either an XX or an XY chromosome. And it's never been shown scientifically that an individual can be, you know, exactly kind of what it says, born in the wrong sexed body, for example. So there is certainly a societal perception that, for example, a woman can be born into a man's body, but biologically, genetically, that doesn't square with those. So I think that's what I mean when I state that, is that
okay.
We have men and we have women.
We had a little bit of an audio glitch there. When we got back together, I asked Dr. Malone whether he thought that confusion over expected gender roles played a part. So in other words, a female, a girl who was more attracted to masculine activities, or a boy more attracted to feminine activities, who concluded that the only way to be interested in those activities was to change sex. And Dr. Malone replied,
in terms of behavior or dress or preferences, whatever that may be. And she does not accept herself for that, or society does not accept her. She doesn't need testosterone to make her look like a boy. She needs help with self-acceptance. And I think that's the basis of the, you know, the therapeutic models of treating gender dysphoria.
Okay, well, we've come close to the end of our time. So is there anything major that you think that anything major that you'd like to mention before we end?
I don't think so. I think we've hit all the major points. That was a good talk.
Well, Dr. Malone, thank you very much for joining me today. I found it very interesting, informative, and hopefully thought-provoking for all of the listeners.
I appreciate it, David, very much.
Okay, thank you. Goodbye.
All right, take care. Bye.
An update on the rather incredible Jonathan or Jessica Yaniv case in Vancouver. This person dragged 16 women who give Brazilian waxes, removal of all female pubic hair, in front of the Human Rights Commission because they refused to wax his scrotum and penis. Two things that came out during the hearing were that Yaniv's mother claimed that he had periods, even though he is a biological male. Also, that Yaniv had previously made racist comments online, such as describing East Indians as curry-shoving crapheads. Just a few days ago on Twitter, Yaniv asked why immigration officials don't carry out more ID checks, citing a part of the Canadian city of Surrey that has a lot of immigrants. This is relevant because the majority of the 16 women are recent immigrants, often poor and without fluency in English. Several have already stopped providing this service. Waxing a man can be done, but requires special training, tools, and even a different wax. Most of the women are from conservative cultures where intimate contact with another man is forbidden, and most do the work out of their home. No decision has been made in the case yet, but I will keep you updated. Thank you for listening to episode 225 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount to Infectious Myth on patreon.com or liberapay.com. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.